Hello, everyone. Welcome to a special reissue of a previous episode of Grey Matter. Last August, we had the pleasure of sitting down with British author Carl Truman, who has written a couple of really fascinating books. One is called Strange New World, and another, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. In this interview, Carl shares his thoughts about gender roles and sexuality in the modern world. We thought that a replaying of this reissue of this episode would be useful, given the current situation in our culture with Drag Queen Story Hour, and of course my own controversy, where, as many of you know, I've been challenging public funding for a drag queen youth event, which has been scheduled in Cold Lake, Alberta. More on that story to come. Anyway, in this episode, Carl Truman and I have a conversation about gender identity and explains the modern implications of these ideas on religion, free speech, and personal identity. In this conversation, we hear Dr. Truman and I unpack the idea of gender identity and the role it plays in Western culture, the importance of sexual identity and the way we collaborate as a society, and why it's important to have these roles to forge a future where everyone fits. I hope that you enjoy this special reissue of our interview with Dr. Carl Truman. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Grey Matter. Well, we are blessed today to have a guest on who I first became aware of a couple of years ago when he published kind of a groundbreaking book that we're going to talk about with him today. I think that he's become one of the most salient thinkers in the context of Christianity and culture, and in terms of explaining what's really going on right now with identity politics. Those of you who follow the show will remember that we had Dr. Philip Salzman on a previous episode, and he talked about the same topic, but from a different point of view, from the point of view of really secular humanism and how these ideas have really infected academia and education. Well, today we're going to talk with Professor Carl Truman, who's written a series of books and has really gone into great depth and detail to explain this phenomenon that's going on, particularly in Western culture. And Professor Truman talks about it from a distinctive Christian perspective, which I find refreshing. I know many of our viewers do, but really not just particular to that. It's his vantage point, I think he'll agree, goes far beyond just the religious, and really mines very deep into the culture, and really crosses, you know, secular lines, and explains really sort of what's going on. So we're very happy to have him on the program today. I'm going to introduce him more formally in a moment. But before we go there, as we always do, I'm going to frame the discussion with a few aphorisms that are really in his honor. The first is from someone that Carl and I both admire, a figure from history, Martin Luther. Those of you who follow the show know that I'm a person of faith. I was baptized and confirmed in the Lutheran Church. Carl has written a wonderful book about Martin Luther. But the first quotation is from Martin Luther. And I'm going to actually ask Carl to talk a little bit about this in the context of his books. Martin Luther wrote, "I am more afraid of my own heart than of the Pope and all his cardinals. I have within me the great Pope self." Of course, that depiction of self is a little bit different than the one that Carl's been writing about, and we want to maybe get him to explain that. Next quotation is also from another Lutheran scholar. I'm showing my bias here. And this is from Helmut Thielicke, who has written a number of wonderful books. One that I'd recommend to you is called The Waiting Father. But he wrote, "The gospel must be preached afresh and told in new ways to each generation, since every generation has its own unique questions. The gospel must constantly be forwarded to a new address because the recipient is repeatedly changing his place of address." And finally, from Reinhold Niebuhr, who wrote that ultimately evil is done not so much by evil people, but by good people who did not know themselves and who did not probe deeply. All right, so who do we have on the show today? Well, Professor Carl Truman. He is a PhD from the University of Aberdeen. He's professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, which he tells us is somewhat in the vicinity of Pittsburgh. He has written more than a dozen books, including Histories and Fallacies, Problems Faced in the Writing of History, Luther on the Christian Life, The Creedal Imperative, and The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, and The Road to Sexual Revolution. That was published, I believe, in 2020. He's got a more recent book, a follow-up book, that we're going to talk about as well. Carl is a professor, as I said, of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He was born and raised in England, earned an MA in classics from the University of Cambridge, and a PhD in church history from the University of Aberdeen. He is an ordained minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church and has served as a pastor, but he indicates hasn't been an active pastor for many years. He has been described as the most brilliant historical analyst of culture in the Christian world today. In late 2020, Carl published what acclaimed cultural commentator Ryan Anderson calls one of the most important books of the past several decades. This is a magisterial work titled The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, and the Road to Sexual Revolution. That's where we sort of want to start, is on this topic of the rise and triumph of the modern self. Welcome to the program, Carl. It's great to have you on Grey Matter.
It's great to be on, Leighton. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I've heard you speak many times over the past couple of years, especially since you wrote this book in 2020, which really rose you to some public prominence and some controversy as well.
Yeah,
maybe a place to start would be, talk a little bit about this book and the rise and the triumph of the modern self. I know it's hard to do. It's a book of about 400 pages. So obviously a great deal of research and work went into it. Maybe start with explaining why you felt the need to write the book on this particular topic.
Sure. It's a good question. First of all, thanks very much for having me on the program. It's a delight to be here. Wonderful to hear your Canadian accent and also see you're a QC. isn't it great to be part of a country where they don't choose their own head of state just at this particular point in time? The origins of the book, really, I was a pastor at the time. I was also an academic. And I think two interests sort of converged as a historian. I'm always interested in why things happen the way they do at particular points in history. Everything that happens always has a backstory. And it's the backstory that's fascinating to the historian. And as a pastor, I was aware that a lot of people in my church were disturbed, confused by the apparent speed at which Western culture was changing on issues that, 50, 60 years ago would have been regarded as unquestionable, solid, static. Sexual morality, for example, and particularly the biological nature of sex, that men are men and women are women. And I became intrigued that these changes within our culture were happening so fast. And inevitably disturbing a lot of people. So what I wanted to do was find out why. And typically, when you see dramatic changes like that happening so fast, it's because there are very deep-seated, long-standing, underlying causes and influences behind them. We see the surface, if you like, in society. We see the changes as they happen. We see the final domino fall. What we don't see is all the dominoes that have fallen before that. So the book was really an attempt to set, particularly the transgender question, how the statement, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, how that became plausible, not simply to gender theorists and way out pointy-headed academics, but to the ordinary man or woman in the street. And indeed, since writing the book, not simply plausible, but has come to be part of the compulsory political liturgy of the West as well. So that was the origins of the book. I wanted to set the transgender issue within the much broader context of how Western people had come to understand what it meant to be a human person over the last few centuries.
This idea of the rapid onset of gender dysphoria among adolescents and teens is something that is increasingly of concern, especially to parents in the culture. Yeah. Particularly, it seems, in the United States, we've seen what's been happening in Virginia and Florida, where this has become actually an important political issue that will swing elections. Has this been a shock to you, a surprise to you, that there's been this this strong public reaction sort of in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic?
I think it's been interesting to see how parents... one of the things I always said about transgenderism was it was always going to be different to, say, gay marriage. You know, there's a sense in which, as a Christian, one might object to gay marriage, but whether my gay neighbors are married or not doesn't impinge upon my life, typically. Mm-hmm. Transgenderism is much more significant, because transgenderism, of course, is transforming. It's not only transforming women's sports, it's also transforming private space, restrooms, toilets, changing rooms, etc., etc. So I always assumed that as transgenderism caught on, it would be a much bigger political issue, because, you know, gay marriage may not be happening in my backyard, but transgenderism is going to be happening, if it isn't happening already, in my backyard. So that, I think, didn't surprise me. And of course, as soon as something starts impinging upon the relationship of parents to children, and I don't know the situation in Canada, but in America now, you have schools claiming the right to know the gender of students, and yet also claiming that they're under no obligation to tell parents about it. As soon as you have a situation where what I would regard as natural ties of obligation start to be weakened or interfered with by ideologues, something's going to happen. You're going to start getting a reaction. So I was not surprised at the speed at which transgenderism gripped the popular imagination. I'm not surprised that it's provoking something of a backlash as well at this point.
We've actually had a situation in Canada where arguably it's even more advanced than it is in some parts of the United States. You might be aware that recently there were some amendments made to the Criminal Code of Canada, which actually criminalized the, you know, the practice of trying to counsel people out of transgenderism or homosexuality. And actually, the way those provisions read, it would make it, strictly speaking, a criminal code offense for a pastor to get up in front of a congregation and teach what's in Corinthians about homosexuality. So, and we've had the same let's call it infiltration of the LGBTQ plus agenda into schools and education, and it is leading to something of an explosion in gender dysphoria. I read actually a piece that was mentioned in New York Magazine, and this was talking about your book, where roughly 30% of American women under the age of 25 identify as LGBTQ, and whereas for women over 60, that figure is less than 5%.
Yeah.
What's the explanation? What's your explanation for that based upon your research, Carl?
Yeah, there are various reasons. First of all, it's important to say that it's not necessarily one size fits all. Not everybody struggling with gender dysphoria is necessarily struggling with it for the same reason. What's interesting is this great explosion, particularly among young women, of transgenderism, but also of identifying as lesbian and bisexual. I would say a number of component parts fit into this. I was talking to a youth worker recently who was telling me that at the middle school where I think his daughter attends, 80% of the girls identifies bisexual. And I asked him, you know, why do you think that is? And he gave an answer that I think has a lot of merit. He said, the problem today is we don't teach kids about friendship. We don't give kids categories for understanding strong feelings they may have for somebody else that don't default to the sexual. So when a young girl feels deep friendship for another young girl, the categories that society is giving her to understand that are sexual categories. So, of course, she's going to identify as bisexual. Whereas when I was young and when you were young, Leighton, probably we had this notion of friendship. We knew that there were strong, sometimes even passionate relationships that could exist between people of the same sex that weren't sexual. If you don't have that concept or that category, and the world is pushing you in the direction of sexual identity all the time, of course you're going to have an explosion of sexual identity. Second aspect of this, and I think this particularly connects to the transgender, the rapid onset gender dysphoria among young people, is it's disproportionately affecting young women. What's interesting, of course, is we've sort of seen this before. Mm-hmm. If you step back from the ideology and you think, well, what is transgenderism? Transgenderism is really a phenomenon where somebody feels very uncomfortable in their body. Where have we seen this before? Well, bulimia and anorexia in the 1980s and 1990s. Mm-hmm. Who did that disproportionately affect? Mm-hmm. Young girls around about the age of puberty, post-puberty, not exclusively so, but predominantly so. And it was an almost therapeutic thing for them. It was a way of being special. It was a way of coming to terms with their body. It was a way of living out a fantasy of belonging. And that's what makes this the bans on conversion therapy so problematic. Now, I've not seen the Canada bill. And certainly, we're all aware there are certain kinds of therapy that have been unleashed on LGBTQ people with which no one would wish to identify. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you're saying to a doctor, for example, that if somebody comes to you and says, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, what you're doing there is you are legislating that claims about gender are the one pathology, if you like, where the patient has the absolute right of self-diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think this gets really problematic. If conversion therapy is preventing people from addressing the modern equivalent of bulimia and anorexia, that's a major disaster. Mm-hmm. And people need to realize, of course, that transgender procedures, pumping the body full of hormones, having surgeries, these are not things that one can recover from. An anorexic could recover from anorexia and go on to live a perfectly normal life. Somebody who's had their penis removed and has had puberty blockers and had their body pumped full of hormones that their body is not built to take, that does permanent damage. Mm-hmm. So it really is, I think, a public health crisis that unfortunately has the full weight of the government and to a large extent the medical establishment right behind it.
Well, I read a very intriguing book that confirms what you've said about the impact of this on adolescent girls by an American writer named Abigail Schreier. Perhaps you're familiar with it, Irreparable Damage, which, as I said, confirms a lot of what you said. But the expansion of this ideology is even broader than that. I can tell you that, for example, in neighboring British Columbia, the province which neighbors Alberta, where I live, when I appear in court there, I have to announce my pronouns before I can address the court.
I'm wondering about your pronouns, actually, Leighton. Yeah, it's sort of, you look rather ambiguous.
Yes. Yeah. It's sort of like they're a wrestler. Yeah. But bringing this into the context of Christianity and religion, though, Carl, I want to be, we have to step carefully, and you do in the book, you are very respectful of people. I should say this, in your writings, you're not casting aspersions. You're talking about things, you know, in a clinical way, but also in a religious way. But it does seem to me, and I really want to get your take on this, that, first of all, the idea of transgenderism is not new. It's fashionable. But it's not new. I can recall, for example, the story of the Emperor Nero, you know, who killed his pregnant wife and then took a young boy and changed his name to the name of his former wife and then married that person. So that really there's a historical connection which predates Christianity there. And of course, so there's a serious question about, for me, whether this whole concept of transgenderism is a worship of the self, as opposed to, you know, the sort of Christian, Judeo-Christian ethic that I was raised with, that you clearly were. So bringing this back to, for example, Martin Luther and that opening quotation, when he talks about him being sort of his own great pope self, could you talk about that, the sort of distinguish the concept of self, that Christian self that Martin Luther was talking about, versus, let's say, the sort of worship of the individual? And I think, how do you put it, the overexpression of self in our modern culture? Could you sort of compare and contrast those ideas?
Yeah, well, in many ways, the statement you took from Luther is presenting there and criticizing or implicitly disapproving of something that really is very akin to the modern notion of self that informs all of our intuitions. What Luther is pointing to there, of course, is the sort of the self-righteous, autonomous self. Well, Luther's problem is human beings are not righteous, nor are we autonomous. We are made dependent and dependent upon God. So the contrast, I think, there would be the Christian notion of the self is the self is not free, the self is not autonomous, the self is not that which can invent itself. And all of those things, I think, are things that are now intuitions of the modern culture in which we live. If there's a single line that sums up the modern view of the self, it might be that from Rousseau, man is born free and everywhere is in chains, where Rousseau really is there saying what makes us human is our autonomy and our freedom. And every other relationship we have is a potential link in a chain that inhibits us, that prevents us from being truly ourselves. So whereas Luther's response to that would be, no, we're not autonomous. We're not free. That's the problem. It's when I set myself up as the great authority of who I should be. That's where the problem begins. For Luther, men and women are who they are because they are addressed by God. And it is what God says that they are, that they truly are. And it's in obedience to his will and in relationship to him that they find their true selfhood.
So the modern self really is the overexpression of the individual identity. Do I have that correctly?
An assertion that I am king and sovereign. We might put it this way. Another aspect of the modern self is that we assume that the world is shapeless, that it has no authority, that it has no moral shape, and whatever significance the world has is significance that we have given it, that it's a piece of cosmic Play-Doh for us to make and reshape at our will. And with transgenderism, I think we've reached the point where we now say that even applies to our own bodies. Even my own body must be subservient to my will. And if my body says I'm one thing and my will desires to be another, then so much the worse for my body.
So what we're seeing and what you talk about in your books really are the dangers, the manifestations of that in Western culture, right? And these have many, for example, taking critical race theory, the vilification of quote unquote, white people. So for example, at Oxford, music students cannot be taught the great masters like Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. And in fact, even characters, musical characters, are not to be learned by people who are studying composition, because this is this is imperialistic and evil. What are the dangers of this for our culture? Are we seeing these right now? And have we reached the end of the line? And in fact, have we seen the bottom of this yet? Or are we still in the midst of it?
Yeah, well, there are many things one could say about the various branches of critical theory. I mean, I might start by saying, on one level, critical theories point to a truth, if you like, that that the world is filled with manipulation. We as Christians know we're fallen, and the cultures that fallen human beings make are not perfect. And there are power games and manipulations that are going on. The problem with critical theory, of course, is that it's ultimately just a negation. All critical theory does is tear down. It doesn't build up because there is nothing to build up. There is no human nature. Human nature is just a construct, a manipulative concept produced by those in power, white heterosexual males, to marginalize those who differ from that powerfully exerted and asserted norm. So bottom line is, can we build civilization on critical theory? No. I think critical theory is, I put it this way, it's a theoretical justification of the abyss. Mm-hmm. It tears down, and it has this, you know, we saw this in the ambitions of Black Lives Matter before they revised their agenda, before people got hold of their agenda, their policy sheet, and they revised it. But looking for the positive vision, there is no positive vision. There's just this naive hope that if we tear everything down, somehow a just and equitable society will rise from the ruins. Well, nothing in history and nothing in human nature would give one any confidence that that will be the case.
Right. And I guess what bothers me the most about it is the dishonoring of the past. I mean, you know, I really see that, especially Western civilization, we're really standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have so much more that we could achieve. We could do so much better. But in a moment when we could be doing that, we've never been more rich, more free, have better access to information, all these things. And yet in this very moment when we could be achieving so much more, we're tearing everything down. That's sort of what you're talking about. The question is, why do you think this is happening, Carl? Why now? What is this phenomenon, and why has it taken such a grip over culture?
Yeah, it's a very interesting. It's an obvious but a very interesting question. I think the short answer is societies and cultures have lost sight of the sacred and the transcendent. I'm not making there a particularly Christian point. There are plenty of societies in history that aren't Christian and yet have some concept of the transcendent, some concept of something greater themselves to which they are answerable. It's what Philip Reeve calls sacred order, that typically societies, stable societies, have organized themselves by referring to something beyond themselves, by referring to something sacred. We don't do that anymore. And that leaves us in the invidious position of having to justify society on the basis of society. I was on a podcast a couple of weeks ago with a couple of guys in the UK, the Trigonometry podcast, and they're very upfront, you know, a couple of secular atheists. They're not people who believe at all, but they asked the question, you know, can you build a coherent society on the basis of atheism? And my answer to that was, well, I wouldn't say no, because I don't have a big enough brain to imagine every hypothetical society out there. So, but I know for certain that if you have no concept of the sacred, you are setting yourself a much harder task than otherwise. And I think that's where we are now. And we see this, you know, thinking of critical theory, you know, intersectionality is now moving to the fore of critical theory, which dismantles the categories of the previous critical theorists. And you end up with an increasingly incoherent take on what is culture. And you also end up with, you know, your comment about erasing the past, you also end up setting the moral bar so high that we will not be judged kindly. I mean, I pointed out a number of times to apparently no effect, but I've written a couple of articles where I pointed out the fact that if you were tweeting using your smartphone about Thomas Jefferson owning slaves, then you're dependent on slave labor, because your smartphone almost certainly tracks back to slave labor in China. And that raises the moral question. Was Jefferson more or less moral than us merely because he owned the slaves? Is it okay if other people own the slaves who work for us? And that, I think, lies at the real problem of society is this utopianism that seems to grip the imagination and feeds what Luther would explain this, is it just feeds our sense of self-righteousness.
Right.
When you peel back the layers, you realize that actually we are arguably complicit in far more evil than many of the people from the past that we stand in judgment on. It's just that our hands appear to be clean because our slaves are thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are very, very fascinating topics and fascinating times. On the subject of building a society on atheism, it would seem to me that the 20th century is a very strong argument against. Yeah. Seems that the Soviets tried that, the Nazis tried that, the Chinese tried that, and a lot of people died.
Yeah.
So atheism might not be a great foundation for a functional society.
Stalin was routinely having more people killed every single day of his regime than the Inquisition slaughtered in its entire history, I think. That's the kind of scale that we're looking at.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so switching from the somewhat controversial to the really controversial, I want to talk to you about a little bit about a piece that you recently wrote concerning a very important legal decision of the Supreme Court in the United States, where you wrote something earlier this month about the Dobbs decision. And the piece is entitled "Christians Should Rejoice Over Dobbs." I agree, but I'd like you to maybe explain the point of the piece and why you wrote it.
Yeah, I think that what's interested me in the Dobbs decision, which of course was the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and therefore, yeah, actually, there's been a lot of misinformation put out about it. Of course, I was reading somewhere last week in the British press saying abortion has been made illegal in the United States. All the Supreme Court have done is said it's not a constitutionally protected right. They've sent it back to the states. I think it should be a source, a cause for rejoicing among Christians. Even though, of course, as with all political decisions and all judicial decisions, it's more complicated than a simple, straightforward battle between good and evil. It's the crooked timber of humanity that brought this about. I think as a decision considered in a punctilio way, it will lead to the saving of lives. And it removes from the United States, at least from the United States Constitution, the stain of infanticide. What surprised me was how quickly some professing Christians moved to try to, you know, I wouldn't say nuance the decision, that's sort of the wrong word, but relativize the decision by focusing on other things, particularly in the liberal Catholic world. I joke with my conservative Catholic friends, I have no idea why there are people in their church who want to be liberal Protestants. They could just come over and be liberal Protestants, but there they are. And also I was struck by the silence in some evangelical quarters. And I think there it's a different issue at play. Obviously, I can't read the minds of pundits, evangelical pundits who didn't speak up straight away. But I think there was Donald Trump was such a divisive figure within American conservative Protestantism that I think it's very hard for those who define themselves very much in opposition to Donald Trump to acknowledge that he did anything good at all. And don't get me wrong, I don't have a vote in America anyway. I carry no brief for Donald Trump as a human being at all, or as a politician. But I think credit where credit's due. Clearly, Roe would not have been reversed were it not for key judicial appointees made by Donald Trump. And for that, I'm grateful to him, and I'm grateful what he did. And I wish that had been a more universally acknowledged thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, having read both these decisions, that is Roe versus Wade and Dobbs, I have to say that Dobbs is a much more cogently reasoned legal decision.
Yeah,
Roe
yeah.
versus Wade was always weak in terms of its legal rationale. It was almost, let's call it judicial gymnastics, trying to create, carve out a constitutional right that really didn't exist. But what's interesting about Roe versus Wade in the context that we're talking about is it really was taking the self, that is the rights of women, almost a bridge too far, wasn't it?
Yes, and I think what you, just as an aside, by the way, up until a couple of years ago, I didn't know any pro-abortion people who thought Roe v. Wade was well argued, that they knew it would fall. And that it's interesting now they're so outraged it's fallen. I'm going to say, no, you should have argued, you should have had a better argument in the first place, as you were saying a few years ago. But yeah, I think it, yeah, Roe is one thing. It's made clearer by Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992, which was another abortion, government funding of abortion kind of case. And there you have Justice Anthony Kennedy, I think, authored the majority opinion in that. And he has this bizarre statement about human autonomy and self-determination. And he roots the state's non-interest in some ways in connecting with abortion in this mystical view of the autonomous human person. So I think you're absolutely right. Roe and Casey emerge from a culture in which human freedom is emphasized and human autonomy is emphasized. And when you think about that, to go back to what I said earlier, if you believe human beings are born free, then every other relationship is potentially adversarial. And you know, what greater burden for one, you know, to use the feminist terminology, what greater burden can one person put on another than emerging from their womb and demanding that that person look after them? So the culture of abortion is closely connected to the abortion of sexual liberation, and indeed closely connected to the underlying ideology of gender identity as well.
Well, moving on to some other controversial topics, I want to talk to you a little bit about something you wrote about Tom Hanks, who just recently starred in a film that I saw, the Elvis Presley biopic.
Great. I love that. I saw that movie. Yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah. Great movie.
It's a beautiful film, actually. And we just had a chance to talk with a Hollywood reviewer named Christian Toto, who was on this program. And he said something that I think is very true. And it's really the only criticism you could make about the film. Is he said, you know, we don't really learn a lot about who Elvis Presley was.
Yeah.
They don't really go into a lot of detail about, you know, his influences, why he became so popular and so on. But Tom Hanks, of course, is in that film. He plays Colonel Tom Parker. But he said something that was somewhat controversial and caught your eye, and you commented on it. I wanted to ask you about this. He said that he recently declared that if Philadelphia, this Oscar-winning film that's from the early 90s, if that were made today, it would no longer be acceptable for him as a straight man to play the gay lead. He says this comment has provided low-hanging fruit for conservative critics. And then the comment here that you made is that Hanks's comment is a function of the fact that perceived victims of the old norms for sex and sexual behavior now enjoy a privileged status in our culture. So I'd like you to comment on that, and also, if you wouldn't mind, perhaps comment a little bit about the role that Hollywood and entertainment is playing, particularly in America, in advancing this let's call it ideology.
Well, first of all, on the Hanks comment, I mean, it's so bizarre. I mean, it's not unprecedented. I've seen such comments before, but this idea, you know, at the heart of acting, it seems to me, the very essence of acting is that somebody pretends to be someone or something that they are not.
Right.
And if we're going to say, well, you know, an actor can pretend to be this, that, or the other, but he cannot be that kind of person or that kind of thing, we have to ask why. What makes that kind of thing special? Why is it okay for Sean Connery, for example, to play the quintessential English secret agent James Bond when he's a Scotsman? Why is that not oppressive to somebody like myself? Why would that still be acceptable today? And yet it's not acceptable for a straight man to play a gay man. And the only reason that can be for that, I think, is the framework of politically correct virtue that now applies in our society, that it's somehow seen as condescending or demeaning or insulting for somebody who is not a marginal victim to play a marginal victim on stage or on screen. It's a ridiculous principle that's simply can only operate in if it's consonant with the spirit of the age. It really makes no sense. In terms of the role that Hollywood are playing, I mean, one of the things that I draw on in my book is, you know, human beings, we're narrative creatures, and we're creatures of sentiment. And we all know that. You know, if I look out of the window and I see a crime being committed in my street, and I need to Google, what do I do to help an old lady being beaten up by thugs? You know, Leighton, you'd say to me, Truman, you're a psychopath. That's not how normal people should be. I should feel something. We are sentimental creatures, and that's not an entirely bad thing. The key is that our sentiments need to be properly attuned. Sentiments are very manipulable by narrative, very manipulable by visual things, by the presentation of circumstances and situations on the screen. So I believe for a long time that the battle for gay marriage was not a battle lost in the realm of argument. Mm-hmm. It was a battle lost in the realm of what I would describe as aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Sitcoms, soap operas, movies where gay people were presented in a very positive fashion. Perhaps they have gay friends who are great people and they really like them. And of course, you know, if you have an ounce of humanity, you're drawn towards nice, likable people. You want them to be happy. And I think Hollywood has proved expert in using aesthetics to shape the sentimental, emotive sort of reactions that we have to moral situations. There's a slight hint that it might be changing. I was sort of a little bit encouraged by the apparent failure of the Lightyear movie at the cinema, and the amazing success, though I'm not a Tom Cruise fan, the amazing success of Top Gun 2 or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me, and again, the Elvis movie I'd put in the same category. When I go to the movies, I want to go to be entertained. I don't want to go to be preached at.
Right.
And I think Hollywood is beginning to get very preachy. It used to shape our sentiments in subtle ways. It's becoming more overtly preachy now. And ironically, that's provoking something, I think, of a reaction, a backlash, and making Hollywood less effective at what it's trying to do.
What's remarkable about that to me is that, take for example, what happened recently with the Disney disclosures, where some of their internal meetings, the contents of that were revealed, and there was some public outrage and protesting about this. And yet in the aftermath of that, Disney proceeded undaunted with release of this Buzz Lightyear film. And so they don't seem to care that this is impacting the bottom line. They seem to be placing this ideology above all, which is somewhat frightening. But I it seems to me that gets at the point of your book, isn't it? I mean, because the ideology that we're talking about really exalts the self. That's what the worship is. And I would say, if you're talking about, for example, wokeness or diversity, inclusion, equity, it's almost risen to the point of a religion. In fact, and maybe the best test of this is if you criticize, if you speak out against that, the reaction is always emotional and visceral.
Yeah.
It's never rational or logical. It's never a point of intellectual disagreement. It's, oh, I hate you because you don't agree with what I believe.
Yeah.
Is that a fair statement about what's going on? I mean, or does that explode your hope that maybe things are changing?
Well, I think what we see there is we do live in an era where people so identify their selfhood with their opinions and their ideas that a disagreement with an idea becomes an attack on the self. You know, back home in the UK, my closest friend in academia was a card-carrying Trotskyite. We got on famously. I mean, he used to joke that come the revolution, he'd have to have me shot. You know, as a bourgeois imperialist, it was nothing personal. It was just, you know, I was on the wrong side of history. And we would laugh about that. And it was, you know, we had fun. We engaged. I think that world is not the world that young people today are growing up in, where who you are is the ideas you have. And if somebody disagrees with your ideas, then they are denying you as a person. And I think that's a real problem. My hope is, you know, is there a glimmer of hope here? My hope is that ultimately that kind of world is unsustainable, which means one of two things has to happen. Either that world has to completely collapse, or it has to pull back from the brink. Mm-hmm. We don't know which way it's going to go until it does one or the other. But I do think that, you know, I'm encouraged there are glimpses of hope. We talked early on about the uprising of parents in Loudoun County, for example, the popularity of the Top Gun movie. There are signs that wokeness remains something of an elite preserve. Now, the problem is the elites, because they're elite, have their hands on the levers of power in the culture. Mm-hmm. But there is some hope, I think, that at the grassroots, this is not having quite the same impact.
I want to pull you. You've been talking a lot about history and culture. I want to pull you into your Christianity for a moment, if you don't mind. And I want you to talk about, speaking of this hope. It's a statistical fact that Christianity is on the rise worldwide. As I believe it's the fastest growing religion. So you've written something about lessons from Luther's stand at Worms 500 years ago today. Can you talk about why you wrote that and why Luther's stand at Worms has something very important for those of us living in the modern age?
Sure. I think perhaps the most obvious point is that truth is not a function of popularity or public opinion. And that Luther's stand is one where ultimately he has to act in accordance with his conscience because of certain convictions about the truth. To use Solzhenitsyn's famous line, Luther is not prepared to, you know, he will live not by lies. Mm-hmm. So I think what Luther points us to is that Christianity, at some point, Christianity is always going to stand in opposition to the great waves of the culture around us. Because it's true, it calls out human beings for what they are, fallen, dependent upon God, and needing to turn to God in order to realize their full humanity. And that's not something that the world is, you know, that's not a particularly marketable thing in the world. So Luther's stand at Worms, I think, more than anything else, is emblematic of, well, at some point, the truth is the truth. And one mm-hmm. has to stand on the truth, regardless of the consequences.
Mm-hmm. That Live Not by Lies is also the title of a great book I recently read by Rod Dreher. And so by way of segue to that, in terms of Luther's stand at Worms, you've also written a piece called Six Ways Christians Can Respond to Our Strange New World. I believe this is something that you very recently published only about a week ago. Mm. So what are the six ways that Christians can respond to this new world that you've been writing about?
You've actually caught me there, Leighton. I have to say, I wrote that some time ago. It was only published last week, and my memory of it is somewhat vague. But I think, if I can sort of dig up what I think I should have said rather than what I maybe did say, is one, I think Christians should not allow themselves to get too distracted by what's going on in the world around. Mm-hmm. Bottom line is, we know how the story ends. The church is going to win. Secondly, I think that Christians should
That's
not.
That's reassuring. That's yes. very reassuring. Thank you for saying that.
Yes. Secondly, and really as a sort of corollary of that, I think this applies particularly to pastors, but we shouldn't allow the world to set our teaching agenda. I think the task of the church, the task of the pastor, is to teach the whole counsel of God. We can end up, if we're always trying to respond to the latest craziness in the culture, and engaging in a kind of whack-a-mole situation. Mm-hmm. Remember some years ago when gay marriage was legalized in Canada, or recognized in Canada some years before America, but around about 2015, when the Supreme Court was wrestling with the case of Obergefell v. Hodges, the one that gay marriage and protected by the Constitution. There mm-hmm. was some in my Presbyterian circle saying, you know, do we need to add to the Westminster Confession of Faith? Do we need to add a paragraph on gay marriage? And my answer to that was no, because what you have in the Westminster Confession is very positive teaching about what marriage is. And by implication, that rules out all of the counterfeits. So we don't need to be describing every kind of illicit union that wants to claim the name of marriage. We simply have to describe the true union, and by implication, everything else stands relative to that. So I think, you know, we need to avoid playing whack-a-mole. I think we also need to make a distinction particularly when it comes to things like the LGBTQ movement. And I've tried to do this in my writings and in the lectures and discussions I've had. We need to make a distinction between the ideology, the ideology and the particular individuals caught up in this. We need to be ruthless in our intellectual opposition to the former. And we need to have the sensitivity of Christ when dealing with the latter. I have not in my time encountered many people who are truly happy, say, with struggling with the idea that they're a woman trapped in a man's body. It's not something the people that I've met glory in or enjoy. It's something that is a burden to them. And I think when we're dealing with real human beings in this strange new world, we need not to lose sight of our common humanity. We need to be compassionate and caring. And that connects to the another point, and that is the church needs to model community. Go back to the transgender craze among young teenage girls. One of the points Abigail Schreier makes in her book is it's a function of wanting to belong, of wanting to be part of a group. And that points to a deeper truth, and that is that we think of ourselves as autonomous and free, but we're actually creatures who need to belong. We need other people to recognize us as creatures of value and people of value. And that points to the importance of community in understanding who we are. And I think it behooves the church to be a strong community. Because if we're not a strong community, then the Christian identity will not be a strong one. And that craving for belonging, that craving to know who we are, people will go elsewhere to find that fulfilled. And so I think, we need solid teaching. We need God-honoring worship. But we also need loving and strong community.
So if we do those things, that will explain in part why you say, you know, we know how the story ends, that the church is going to win. Your last comment there reminded me of something that I read in a book by Douglas Murray called The Madness of Crowds, where it's his view that the seeds of destruction are built into this intersectionality. And he has this metaphor in the book of this train that comes through the station and goes off the rails. And I really see that as an opportunity for the church, the Christian church, to come in and be a source of light and hope for people who are really, as you say, they're suffering and they're despairing. They're looking for answers, looking for meaning, which of course, someone like Viktor Frankl said, you know, after food and water, that's the number one sustenance that human beings need. So I'm like you, I really have a lot of empathy for people who are suffering through gender dysphoria. But what I object to, and what it sounds like, you're of the same view, there's a point at which that ideology is imposed, and it requires my adoption of it as part of my own personal philosophy or indeed theology. And it's at that point where I'm conscientiously objecting. I'm saying, yes, I care about you. I care about what happens to you, but not to the point where I'm going to adopt and accept your way of thinking, your way of living. But does that make sense to you, or is that going past what you're saying?
No, I think that absolutely makes sense. We're living at a time where it's not enough to tolerate those who differ. They have to be affirmed. I don't know if you followed the recent kerfuffle in the United Kingdom over comments by the pop star Macy Gray.
Yes, I did.
I know that she's sort of done public repentance, but initially she'd essentially said, and she was more concessive than I would be. She was saying, I'll even use, if you're transgender, I'll even use your pronouns, but I'm not going to consider you to be a true woman. I'm not. And not even that was considered to be acceptable. So you're thinking, this woman is going to do everything outwardly that these people demand. But in her mind, she's dissenting on one point. Unfortunately, she's expressed that publicly, and now they're coming after her mind. And that, I agree with you. I think the problem is, it's not a question of live and let live. It's a question of my way or the highway. the way this has been
played out. And taking Macy Gray, that's a great example, because sadly she had to give this really cringeworthy apology that she didn't seem to mean or be very sincere about. And so this gets back to the comment that you said earlier, live not by lies.
Yeah.
So we're put into this situation where we must lie. I mean, fundamentally it is a lie at bottom. And so when we do that, we're really making this problem of spiritual alienation worse, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of performative repentance that, it doesn't mean anything beyond it reasserts the power of the people who really control our society. The Macy Gray apology reminded me of obviously the consequences for her are very, very different, but those ridiculous confessions that the victims of the Stalin show trials had to make.
Oh, yes.
When everybody knew that, that it was complete nonsense. And yet everybody went along with the act. Everybody had to perform in a particular way. It's a kind of soft totalitarianism. I think that's Rod Dreher. We mentioned Rod a few minutes ago. It's this kind of soft totalitarianism that's descending on us. And it's manifesting itself in the ways that totalitarianism always does. It demands the performance of a dishonest liturgy, essentially. In order to survive.
Well, this conversation has lived up to my best hopes and then some. Thank you so much, Carl. This has been just wonderful talking with you, so insightful, and talking about your books. We're at the point of the program here where we have something called the reading list. And I'm going to ask you to pick out a couple of your favorites from, I'm sure, a very, very ample bookshelf and memory. But today it won't shock you to learn that we're showcasing two of your books. We've talked a lot about the one that you wrote a couple of years ago, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, and the Road to Sexual Revolution. The description here is, modern culture is obsessed with identity. Since the landmark Obergefell versus Hodges Supreme Court decision in 2015, which you talked about, sexual identity has dominated both public discourse and cultural trends, yet no historical phenomenon is its own cause. From Augustine to Marx, various views and perspectives have contributed to the modern understanding of the self. I'm working my way through this book right now, and I'm enjoying it very much. But their follow-up book, which you published more recently, I believe this year, is called Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity and Sparked the Sexual Revolution. Description here is, how did the world arrive at its current disorienting state of identity politics, and how should the church respond? Carl Truman shows how influences ranging from traditional institutions to technology and pornography moved modern culture toward an era of expressive individualism, which we've talked about today. Investigating philosophies from the Romantics, Nietzsche, Marx, Wilde, Freud, and the New Left, he outlines the history of Western thought to the distinctly sexual direction of present-day identity politics and explains the modern implications of these ideas on religion, free speech, and personal identity. I'm looking forward to reading that book as well. Before I get you to add a couple of your favorites, I wonder if you could just tell us why or how you got the idea to write this this follow-up book, The Strange New World.
It really came from my friend Ryan Anderson, who's president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and which is I'm a fellow there, and it's a think tank that seeks to influence policymakers. And his comment to me was, he said, I loved your book. He said, but there's a big problem. And I said, what? And he said, it's too long. People aren't going to read it. And he essentially said, I need something that I can put in the hands of hard-pressed Hill staffers that they can read on the commute in a morning. And so the short book really was driven by that. Though I'm very gratified. It seems to have been picked up by a lot of pastors who were looking for something accessible to do a Sunday school from. So I think it's sort of it struck and interesting enough, I've not only had correspondence from some Jewish people who've been using the books, but I've started to get correspondence from some imams and Muslims who are now using the book as well. So it seems to have hit a note across the spectrum. So I'm very gratified by its success and delighted to think that it seems to be helping people.
That book's too long comment reminds me of a scene from Amadeus where the emperor says to Mozart, there are too many notes. Do you remember
that's
that?
That's right, yes. Yeah, I'd forgotten that. That's a great scene and a great movie. Yeah.
So what are some of your favorites, that you would recommend along the lines of, not necessarily what we're talking about today, but books that you think you would recommend to people to read just to give them some sense of hope and understanding of some of the things you've been writing about?
Yeah, the books on hope are a little short on the ground at the moment, a bit thin on the ground at the moment. But I think, I do think being informed is important. You mentioned Abigail Schreier, Irreversible Damage. I would also add there's a new book, and she would be a wonderful guest actually on your program. Abigail Favale's book, The Genesis of Gender, is an extremely good
book. That one yet. Thank you.
It's published by she's a Catholic writer. It's published by Ignatius Press. So I would definitely think about those. And of course, you mentioned Douglas Murray. I think Madness of Crowds is an extremely extremely useful book. In terms of positive construction, Rosaria Butterfield's The Gospel Comes with a House Key. For those who don't know about Rosaria Butterfield, she was professor of queer theory at Syracuse University in New York State and was converted to Christianity. She's now the exclusive psalm-singing wife of a Reformed Presbyterian pastor. She wrote her testimony, a beautiful autobiography, Confessions of an Unlikely Convert. But she followed that up with a book on The Gospel Comes with a House Key, which is a beautiful, I would say, hymn to the value of hospitality in the Christian world. And then finally, I would add, I'm a big fan of the writings of the conservative philosopher Roger Scruton.
Oh, yes. And,
if you want to, perhaps my favorite book by Scruton has the slightly facetious title of I Drink, Therefore I Am. Philosopher's Guide to Wine.
A lot about wines in that one.
Yeah, the first half is just Scruton showing off how much he knows about wine. But the second half is this, again, a sort of a beautiful hymn to the power of, particularly of wine, but one might say of table fellowship, of eating and drinking together, to human friendship. And if there's any hope today, I think the hope we have in the short term is not at the national level. I think the national situation in Canada and America is lost. But we can still find beauty and friendship in our local communities. And that's where I think Scruton's emphasis upon home, on place, upon sitting around the dinner table and sharing a meal and a glass of wine together is so beautiful. So I would commend that as well.
Yeah, I think he calls it oikophilia. Yeah, his books are beautiful, wonderful prose writer, as are you. And thank you so much for being here. It's been a wonderful conversation, educational, and frankly, somewhat inspirational.
Thanks for having me on.
I hope that everyone will get out and read your books. I hope you'll also consider coming back again.
Absolutely.
You write your next book.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to. It's going to be on critical theory. So if you want to talk about critical theory, I'd be happy to come on.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, I'm going to have a quotation from the late Roger Scruton then next time for you.
Excellent. Excellent.
Thanks very much for being with us, Carl. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on Grey Matter today.
Great. Thanks for having me.